Okay, the topic for our first panel is paths to the judiciary. And format is I'm just going to do a very brief introduction for each of our three judges on the panel with me. And then I've got a series of questions that I'm going to ask them about their career and what it's like as a judge. There will be time for audience Q&A at the end, so if you've ever wanted to reverse the power structure and ask the questions of the judges, now is the opportunity. So starting on my far left and your right, Judge Michael Abrahamian. Judge Abrahamian received his bachelor's degree with honors in political science and behavioral science and law from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He received his law degree from Yale, where he was the publishing editor of the Yale Law Journal. Following law school, he served as a law clerk to Judge Richard Cudahy on the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit. In 2014, Governor Scott Walker appointed Judge Abrahamian to fill a vacancy on the Waukesha County Circuit Court. Prior to taking the bench, Judge Abrahamian was a partner and a litigator at Foley & Lardner here in Milwaukee, with emphasis on shareholder disputes, fiduciary duties, licensing issues, and insurance law. He is a frequent speaker on professional responsibility and legal ethics, and he served as Foley's partner in charge of ethics training. Since 2017, he has taught law governing lawyers as an adjunct at Marquette Law School. Seated in the middle is Justice Rebecca Bradley. Justice Bradley is a Milwaukee native. She graduated from Marquette University with honors in a BS in Business Administration and Business Economics and received her law degree from the University of Wisconsin Law School. Justice Bradley was elected to the Supreme Court in 2016 after being appointed by Governor Scott Walker the prior year. She is the first Wisconsin Supreme Court justice to serve on all three levels of our state court judiciary. Before joining the Supreme Court, Justice Bradley served as a judge in the District 1 Court of Appeals and a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge. She also worked in private practice, including service as a vice president of legal operations for a global software company. Seated next to me, Judge William Griesbach is a graduate from both Marquette University and Marquette University Law School. Following his graduation from law school, he was a clerk to the Honorable Bruce Belfus, Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He then served as a staff attorney at the United States Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit in Chicago. He then joined the Green Bay law firm of Liebman, Conway, Olenichek, and Jerry, and worked in private practice in the area of civil litigation. Up until 1987, at which point he took a position as an assistant district attorney in Brown County. He held that position for 8 years until his appointment to the Brown County Circuit Court by Governor Tommy Thompson. In 2002, Judge Griesbach was appointed by President George W. Bush as the first United States District Court judge in the Eastern District of Wisconsin, Green Bay Division. Judge Griesbach took senior status effective December 31st, 2019, but still maintains a full caseload. So what I will do here is I'll start my questions. Why don't we start with Judge Abrahamian, then we'll work this way, and then we can reverse up the order as I move around with the questions. But I gave brief bios, but Judge, why don't you tell us a little bit about your career and what you did and the experiences you had before becoming a judge?
Sure. So after law school, I clerked for Judge Cudahy. You said Cudahy. First question I asked the judge, I said, how do you pronounce it, Cudahy or Cudahy? And he said, if I'm in Wisconsin, it's Cudahy. If I'm in Illinois, it's Cudahy. Okay, but I clerked for him for a year in Chicago, and then I joined Foley & Lardner and had a lot of terrific mentors. I worked with Mary Kay Braza, Rick Essenberg, Brian McGrath, John Christensen, John Dawson, Tom Schreiner, had some terrific mentors doing all different kinds of law. The colleagues that were my level were Mike Brennan, Brian House, Andy Ronsky, Brett Ludwig. And we were so busy that we were getting into court all the time, arguing big summary judgment motions, having trials as first, second year associates. It was terrific. So we had a terrific experience there and just loved it. And so I did different kinds of area law. We can get into that later. But I was there for 21 years when I eventually applied to become a judge. So it was a great experience. Is Judge Kesmark still here? He was probably in my office at Foley, looking out over the Calatrava, great office. My office looked out over Summerfest, and then my new office when I became a judge was a gerbil tube from the jail to the courtroom. I didn't have no view whatsoever. But it was a great law firm. It's still a great law firm. A lot of great people there, and I learned a lot. The mentors I had were not just terrific litigators, but just highest ethical standards, and were very diligent advocates on behalf of their client, and it taught all of us how to be really good lawyers.
I recall you telling me at one point the hardest thing about transitioning from private practice to the bench was the view. That was the biggest adjustment.
It was the view, and I called my secretary and said, take a picture of my view, which looked out over Summerfest on the top floor of the U.S. Bank building, looking out over Summerfest. I could feel the music on the glass. Take a picture and make it so I can put it over my view right here, and it'll help me transition.
Justice Bradley.
Thank you, Matt. So I started practicing law in 1996 after graduating from the University of Wisconsin. And I first practiced with Hinshaw & Culbertson in Milwaukee, doing primarily medical malpractice defense and insurance defense and insurance coverage defense. So I was in court a lot, and I had the benefit of being able to, most of the time, second chair of big medical malpractice cases with some of the best trial attorneys in Wisconsin on both sides. And it was a terrific experience for me. I loved being a litigator. And I decided after a few years that I didn't want to be so specialized in that niche area. So I lateraled over to what was then White Hirschbeck Dudek, now Hush Blackwell. I don't really recognize the firm anymore. It's very different. And I was doing mostly commercial litigation. And in the year, around the year 2000, got a knock on the door from a partner who was practicing primarily, but not exclusively, in the realm of software and technology, and asked if I'd work on a case. And there was born my technology law career in the infancy of internet law and that sort of thing. Really interesting work to do. I did that for many years, and then had an opportunity to go in-house with a software company client of mine. So I developed a transactional practice. I did that for a few years, really missed being in court and missed litigation. So I returned to White Hirschbeck and had kind of a split practice of litigation and transactional law, negotiating and developing contracts for the software industry and the tech industry with a litigator's eye. So sometimes that drove my clients crazy because I would point out the pitfalls of certain provisions in contracts because I could see the litigation, that potential for certain things, terms, provisions that the client was agreeing to. But it was a really interesting practice. And probably about a year before I joined the bench, I became a AAA arbitrator, and that developed my interest in moving from the arguing side of the law to the decision-making side of the law.
Just to follow up on something, Justice, you mentioned you had this dual practice of transactional litigation. Is that common in larger firms? It seems that now the associates get siloed into a practice group and there's not much cross-pollination.
I'm 10 years out of the legal practice at this point, so I'm not sure what's common anymore. But at that time, it was somewhat atypical, particularly in that sector.
It's very uncommon. At Foley, if I was on the transactional floor, I was like Darth Vader. Oh my God, there's a litigator here on the transaction. Somebody screwed up. Somebody's being sued. Here's the litigator. They never got together. So you were very unique to be able to do that.
I think that's actually accurate because even well back then at White Hirschbeck, there were three practice groups, transactional, litigation, and IP. And I think I was the only attorney at the law firm at that time who was a member of all three.
Is it true that the litigators generally pick on the transactional attorneys and sort of bully them around?
Yes. Yeah. As John Christensen would say, there are two kinds of lawyers. There's litigators and loan closers. If you're not a litigator, you're a loan closer.
We call them propeller heads.
They're propeller heads, right. Too. Yeah.
Judge Griesbach, can you give us an overview of your career before becoming a judge?
Yeah, I right out of law school, I clerked for the Chief Justice Bruce Beilfuss on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It was a he was considered kind of the swing vote in some ways. Justice Abramson was a very young justice at that time, but her work habits were already legendary. But I spent a year there, and I enjoyed clerking a lot. I had the opportunity then to go to the Seventh Circuit. Chief Judge at the time was Judge Tom Fairchild, and he hired me to be a staff attorney. A staff attorney was generally one of unassigned clerks that handled mostly unargued cases. Every now and then a case you had, you would recommend argument, and they'd do that. But you'd put together a number of cases and propose decisions and then sit down with a different panel. You ended up working with all of the judges over the couple years I was there, and it was a two-year term. It was also interesting to see the court transition. When I started, the chief judge was Thomas Fairchild, then it became Judge Cummings became the chief, and I saw the addition of Judge Coffey from Milwaukee, Judge Posner, I think Judge Easterbrook was still a few years, but you saw a real transition in the court, what the Seventh Circuit became, much more the economic analysis approach. So that was interesting. When I left Chicago, frankly, I didn't even want to go to Milwaukee. I had two kids by that time, and we looked. I ended up in Green Bay. The word was, and Collins Fitzpatrick told me, that there was about to be a federal court in Green Bay. So I thought that would be a good place to practice. I had some good federal experience as a staff attorney, and I'll be on the ground floor when this new federal court comes up. Well, it was 20 years later that the court came up. But in the meantime, I went to work for a relatively medium-sized firm, or even a large firm in the Green Bay area, but anywhere around here it would be considered a very small firm, which means that you do everything, and you're not fortunate to get into trials. You have to get into trials. They start you right away because they don't have the resources, so you end up in court pretty fast. It was a variety of cases. The first case I tried was a 1983 case in front of Judge Reynolds. But mostly it was state court, insurance defense, or plaintiff's work. The firm I was with did both. And then I enjoyed private practice, but I also was looking forward, or had experience in law school working in the DA's office. So I decided I was going to transition. So I went to the Brown County DA's office, where you're really in court much more, because trials, even by that time, were becoming more scarce for private practice. The way to get in court was really in the district attorney's office, and so I was there for about 8 years. I ended up applying for a judgeship. The first time, the person that got it ahead of me, I was a finalist through that process, so I thought that was interesting to get that far. I was still fairly young. And I wasn't the pick, but the person that was the pick won the election, and then he had a heart attack and passed away. I applied again. Again, I was a finalist, but just before the decision was made, Judge Hanaway, or Attorney General Hanaway, lost the election, and he put his name in, and then he was the next judge. And then the third time, I ended up being selected for to fill out a term. And I ran unopposed for two terms, and that was it.
I want to touch on something that all three of you alluded to, which is early trial experience in your career, which is evaporating unless you're in the district attorney's office. We hear the lament about the loss of civil jury trials, but is it necessarily a bad thing for society versus the practice of law? And I'll open it up to anyone about the decline in civil jury trials.
I think it depends on why we're not seeing trials. I think the real reason is it's just become so cost prohibitive. Clients are willing to pay huge amounts. Nuisance fees, nuisance or settlement value is so high that I think more and more people cannot afford to go to trial. And I think that the costs of trials have made it much more rare. But I also think, of course, because of the cost, people are doing more and more with arbitration, mediation, other ways of resolving cases. But it seems to me the real sad thing is the cost of litigation has risen so sharply.
And as a result, younger attorneys aren't getting trials. And for me, that was where the fun was. I remember I had a trial one day with a really bad day in trial. A witness changed their answer, and a young associate, as I gave this one witness to this young associate, and our witness changed their answer and got impeached with their deposition. He did a great job handling it. I told him afterwards, I said, where it's like 10 o'clock, we're just winding down. I'm like, even though today was a bad day, isn't this fun? He looked at me and said, today's the worst day of my life. And after trial, he went to employee benefits and left, and he went to get a PhD in history.
Nice work.
Career.
But trials are fun if you're a litigator, and that's where you learn the practice of law. And if you're not getting that experience like a lot of us got early on, it makes it very difficult.
I would echo the same things that the other judges have said. It's certainly bad for the legal profession, and it's bad for young associates getting the experience that they need to be able to handle cases independently and larger cases as their career expands. But when I was practicing, I would advise a lot of my clients, especially in the technology sector, or financial services, where the facts and issues are very complex, I would advise them usually to select arbitration rather than having disputes go to court, just because the arbitration panel then that is selected has subject matter expertise, either as lawyers or as business people, engineers, depending on the type of contract. And so they're going to have a jury, if you will, a decision maker, who understands the industry more than lay people or the average circuit court judge. And so they're going to typically get a better result from decision makers who understand the subject matter of the contract.
And do you think that rise in arbitration is preferable to having these cases go to jury trials and having specialist decisions as opposed to generalist judges deciding the questions?
I think it depends on the case.
We could have a whole panel discussion on that.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on now to the biggest case of the file that you worked on as an attorney. So I'll start with Judge Griesbach and work the way down.
When I was in civil litigation in private practice, we had a huge case with Dow Chemical, which involved a mortar additive they had that seemed to have been breaking down around the country. And so that was a huge case in which we would go to Midland, Michigan, and back before electronic documents and computers, you went through boxes and boxes of documents. And that case lasted for four or five years. It ended up short of trial, but that was the largest case I was involved in civilly. In the DA's office, I had a number of cases. One got made into a TV movie. It was one of these bodiless homicides where the wife disappears and 10 years later we try the husband for the murder. And that was a very interesting case. Ann Gillian was the star. It's a really horrible movie. But anyhow, that was one case. And then the last case I was involved in the district attorney's office was the Monfils case, which was a sixth defendant, a homicide out of the James River paper mill that has been in the news again.
Who played you in the movie, Judge?
I don't remember who played me, but the judge they made, it was Judge Greenwood, they made him a female. I don't remember who played me, to tell you the truth. It wasn't anybody notable.
no say in it. Justice Bradley?
None of my cases would have made for a good TV or movie. I don't remember having a big case in the sense of a big dollar value, but some of the moments in my career that stand out to me that were the biggest professional challenge were when I had this blended practice of litigation and transactional work. And so I remember one particularly crazy moment in my career when I was litigating by day. I had a big, complex, multi-million dollar financial services arbitration that I was an advocate in by day. And then kind of in the overnight and early morning hours, I had an international transaction that I was negotiating. So it was kind of literally working night and day. I survived. I had a fantastic secretary who kept me sane through that crazy time. But that was the one of the types of challenges that I experienced having this type of unique practice.
Judge Abrahamian?
I had a case that started in 1997. It was for a German company involving a licensing dispute over medical technology known as electrochemiluminescence that they used for medical diagnostic equipment. And the American company was the licensor, and we represented the licensee in this technology agreement. Five trips to Germany, there was worldwide discovery. It went to trial, involving billions of dollars for 3 months in the District of Maryland. That was a big case. Right after that one, I ended up representing the Bodines musical group. When that went to trial for 7 days in Milwaukee before Christopher Foley, I still keep in contact with Kurt Newman. I still go see him all the time. That was a fun trial. And then in 2005, so right when the Bodines case ended, I got involved with the Jack Link's Beef Jerky shareholder dispute. That started in 2005. I was lead counsel on that one, as I was in the Bodines case. That went to trial in 2008 for a month and a half in Washburn County. It went up to the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals twice. I became a judge in 2014. The case was still going. I checked about a year ago. It's still going. The gift that keeps giving to the attorneys. So 2005, the case was still pending because of all the number of companies they had, different jurisdictions, post-judgment issues, complicated case, but lots of fun.
I want to turn now to when the three of you decided you were open to becoming a judge, when that interest was sparked. And I'll start with Justice Bradley.
I think I alluded to it earlier. I had become a AAA arbitrator and realized that I really enjoyed the decision-making function. And so when a retirement led to a vacancy on the Milwaukee Circuit Court, after talking to some of my friends and colleagues about it, I decided to apply, and my application was successful. So it was that experience. I think it was important from my perspective because I really did enjoy litigating and arguing cases. It was that experience with decision making that led me on the judicial path.
Judge Griesbach?
I appreciated or I felt I had a reasonably good chance of becoming a judge. I don't know when I first thought I'd want to be a judge, but I thought it was a realistic possibility, mostly from being in the court a lot and getting some positive feedback. And then when I applied, I said I applied three times, just so don't lose heart. But when I made it to the finalist and went through the committee process and filled out the applications, I became pretty confident that there was a good chance I could make it to the bench. In terms of the ability to do the job, you know, really, I think if you practice a lot and you're in courts a lot and you have some experience, I think you see judges that you admire and think, okay, I could do some of this or learn this or become this. And I guess it was over a period of time, but primarily when I was in the district attorney's office is where I really thought I had a decent shot at taking the bench.
Judge Abrahamian?
I think anybody who clerks for a judge, there's a seed in the back of your mind that's planted that I may want to be a judge someday. So I've had that seed ever since clerking, but it never really came to the forefront. My father passed away in 2010, and when something like that happens, you kind of do the rocking chair test. You're sitting back when you're older in a rocking chair. If you look back in your life, do you have any regrets? I started thinking about that. I thought, hey, that seed's been growing in the back of my mind for a while now. At that time, trials becoming more scarce. The practice law wasn't as fun as it used to be. It all was discovery. Electronic documents, ESI, looking at that on a computer. And then having pissing contests over discovery disputes to try and get leverage to ultimately settle the case. That wasn't as fun as it used to be. It used to be fun just trying cases. And we weren't trying as many cases. So I loved what I was doing at Foley. I loved the people. At some point in time, it just kind of went like this. Like, I'm more interested in doing that. And then I applied and I got it. And it's the best job I've ever had.
I want to ask about the application process that all of you went through in becoming a judge. Justice Bradley, you were, as I alluded to in your introduction, you were appointed to all three levels of the Wisconsin court system. Was the application process different from Circuit Court to Court of Appeals to Supreme Court? And if it was, could you talk about those distinctions?
To some extent, it was different, but from what I remember from the physical application process, Governor Walker, I would applaud for having a very comprehensive process for selecting judges. The application, I'm trying to remember, it's been a while, but I think my actual application, excluding attachments of writing samples, briefs, that sort of thing, was probably 40 to 60 pages long, lots of questions to answer, essay questions about best and worst Supreme Court opinions, questions about judicial philosophy. So the application, I don't remember being particularly different for any of the three levels. The interviewing process varied because of the differences among the circuit court and the appellate positions. So I remember for the circuit court position, the first layer of that process was to sit with the Judicial Advisory Selection Committee. It was probably about a 10 to 12 people in a conference room who kind of fired questions at me to answer. And I remember one of the questions, I was 41 years old at the time, and one of the questions I got was, well, if you become a circuit court judge, you're going to have a lot of more seasoned attorneys appearing in front of you, people who are older than you. Well, how are you going to handle that? Are you going to be able to command the courtroom? And because of my transactional experience, my response was, well, I've negotiated contracts with the C-suite at Best Buy and Chevron and companies like that, so lawyers aren't going to intimidate me on the bench. But the questions were more targeted, of course, for the circuit court experience, which is quite different from the appellate experience. But one of the questions that you get from these committees is also about electability and how are you going to run a campaign and what's your experience with that. I hadn't had any experience running a campaign. Court of Appeals process and the Supreme Court processes were somewhat similar to Circuit Court after that initial meeting and interview with the entirety of the Selection Advisory Committee. Then there was an interview process with the governor's chief legal counsel, deputy legal counsel, and I believe the chairman of the selection advisory committee. And certainly for the appellate interview process, the questions were much more focused on judicial philosophy, which was the key selection criteria, I think, for Governor Walker. And of course, for the Supreme Court interview process, that was very particularized for the Supreme Court itself, and the questions were about the nuances of the Supreme Court. I remember getting questions about what changes I would propose to the internal operating procedures of the Supreme Court, that sort of thing. So the final step in the process was always an interview with the governor, and his questions were very much focused, laser focused, on judicial philosophy. And I really enjoyed having those conversations at every step of the process.
Judge Griesbach, what was the application process like in the Thompson administration?
Similar. The Thompson administration had a number of people that were on their Judicial Selection Commission or that would travel around the state, but they'd also get a few local attorneys. And you'd go through an it was a questionnaire. I don't think it was 40 pages, but it was a thorough questionnaire. They're interested in legal philosophy, but they did a lot of discussions with the judges in the area, the judges who you appeared, other attorneys who you had cases with, some of your own colleagues. They were very interested in trying to. I think that the whole selection process and the use of commissions is to try to insulate the governor from political pressures to appoint somebody who perhaps would be a big donor or a partisan appointment, and at least have some input from the bar and those who were familiar with the candidates. And so it was somewhat of a lengthy process, but it was similar, I think, to what Governor Walker did. And the last step in it was, of course, the governor. You'd meet with the governor. There were usually three finalists, and then he would interview them and make a choice.
Now, open this up to Judges Abrahamian and Griesbach, and I'll start with Judge Abrahamian. You've gone through the application process at the state court level and also went through it at the federal level and were a finalist in the Eastern District a few years ago. Describe the difference in the process between the two courts.
Both were the employment equivalent of a colonoscopy. How much you have to fill out for both. It was like 40 some pages, and you have to disclose like all the prior cases you had. So when I'm applying for the circuit court for the advisory committee for Governor Walker, it's all the big cases, all opposing counsel, the holdings in the cases, everything, almost every case you handled that they could find on CCAP, disclosing all that. Answering all the questions about judicial philosophy, the favorite case, worst case, that type of thing. And then going through the interview process was about 10 people when I went through it as well. I liked my job at Foley, so I went in kind of on a hoot. Like, if I get it, great. If I don't, I'm still happy. So I went in, and it was a funny interview. And people have come up to me after we were there in that room, said, that was the funniest interview we ever had. Because I was so laid back about it. It's like, if I get it, I get it. I know what I don't. I still have a good job. And a matter of fact, I'll take a big pay cut if I get it. So I got through, and then we interviewed. It was Brian Hagedorn and Mike Brennan, and did that. That was much more judicial philosophy. That was a much longer interview. That was about 45 minutes to an hour. And then ultimately, I was a finalist, and I got interviewed by the governor. And I thought, now the pressure's off. We're going to take our coats off. We're going to sit in a little love seat. And, you know, hand on the knee, tell me about yourself, Mike, and be really informal. It was not that. He was very interested. It was all business. And I remember distinctly one of the questions was, if I come out to Waukesha in a year and I bump into somebody in the hallway, what are they going to say about Judge Abrahamian? Mike, that's a great question. And it makes me think. So I'm like, well, he's a lawyer's judge. He's fair. He's diligent. He's prepared. And he runs a tight ship. And I thought it was a great question because it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If I think those are the important things, if I want people to answer that way, I better be that kind of judge. So I try to be that kind of judge. But I thought that was a great question. And I've used that when I've interviewed people now. I think it's a great question. So I ultimately got it, which is great. Then I applied for the federal judgeship. And so there I'm disclosing 40, 50 pages, but it's not about my prior cases I handled. It's about prior cases I decided. And so I put together a chart of every writ decision I worked on, every trial I had, and that was 50 some pages, another colonoscopy, disclosing all that. There, the interview then was with the commission set up by both the senators, Senator Baldwin and Senator Johnson, so three people, very much on judicial philosophy. And I thought it went well. It wasn't as funny as the other one. I was a little nervous, more nervous for that one than I was the other one. And I became a finalist, and I interviewed in Washington with White House counsel and Department of Justice, six, seven guys. And the interview was at 11:30 in the Eisenhower building. I forget which building. It wasn't the White House, but it was in this building. And I got there at 8 o'clock. I literally woke up at 4. I wanted to make sure where it was, and I walked and I found it, came back, showered, got there early. I'm reading a James Bond book for a couple hours. I go to the room, it's 11:25, there's no one there. It's now 11:27, there's no one there. I'm thinking, am I in the wrong place? This is the biggest interview of my life. At 11:30, seven guys come walking out of the hall. Judge Abrahamian, here we go. We walk in, okay, here we go. I'm in the right spot, this is good. And tough interview, about half hour, all judicial philosophy, going through questions about original intent, everything. I thought it went pretty well, but ultimately I didn't get it. So very similar to process, very similar application, I would say, and the interview kind of staged up, very similar, colonoscopy both times.
Judge Griesbach, can you describe your colonoscopy with the Eastern District?
I didn't think of it as a colonoscopy, but it was a memory trip, a trip through time. And at first, I wasn't going to apply. The seat I got was a brand new seat. They created that seat that I thought was coming when I moved up to Green Bay. It arrived 20 years later. And instead of practicing it, I actually might have a chance to be the judge. At least I was encouraged to apply. Although the consensus at the time was that Justice Crooks was going to be the new federal judge in Green Bay. But with encouragement of some, I thought, okay, maybe I'll apply. But then I had my first reelection. I had been elected without opposition. I like running that way. It's you can beat the write-ins usually with no money. Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck, they might get a couple, but generally you can win. And I didn't want to invite opposition. So I'm thinking maybe I should just hold off. It's going to go to somebody else anyhow. And I hemmed and hawed, and I thought, well, I better get the application because it sounds like it's long enough that I should probably start filling it out in case I decide to do it. So when I started filling it out, I actually, like I said, it was kind of a trip through memory lane. It was I thought there were some interesting things I had done. And so I filled out the application. There were several of the Brown County judges, Judge Dietz, Judge McKay, a number of us were going to throw in our applications. And Judge Dietz offered to drive them down. They were due the day after Labor Day. And he said, well, I'm going to drive down to Madison. You want me to take yours? And I said, oh, okay. So I hemmed and hawed. I almost took them back. He said, give me them. So he took the applications in boxes because they need multiple copies. And again, this is before everything's online. He's driving them down. I'm on the bench that day. I get a call at about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's Judge Nazzi. He says, Bill, I just got a call from the Rosendale Police Department. They found a box in a ditch with all these papers and your name all over it. That was our, I mean, we had some humorous judges. But then, you know, that was like the day after Labor Day. This is 2001. 9/11 is a week later. And everything changed. And the interviews, I was fortunate. I got an interview. And the interviews were in a very different atmosphere because we were just recovering from that. And the question was, what is this going to mean to our law? What does it mean for the Fourth Amendment? What are reasonable searches in an environment in which terrorists can take down an entire building in no time, and they're talking about dirty bombs and anthrax? So it was in that atmosphere that the application process went through. And of course, the FBI is busy, looking for threats to the country and tracking down terrorists. So the process is a little bit slow, but I get a committee ends up with they chose five finalists, and I was among them. So was Justice Crooks. We had President Bush was the president at the time, but the Democrats held the Senate. And we had both Senator Feingold and Senator Cole were the two Democratic senators, both holding the valuable blue slip that's so important in the federal district court, or used to be Court of Appeals appointment process. So the way they decided to do it is the committee that I appeared in front of was named by those two senators, but also Congressman Sensenbrenner, the senior Republican representative at the time. So that, and then the dean of the law school chaired the committee. And I think it was by majority vote or whatever, but they picked five finalists. We were then interviewed by the legislative members, the Sensenbrenner and the two senators, and they narrowed it to three. And Justice Crooks was not among the three. I got a call. Actually, my father was ill. I was visiting him. My secretary calls me on a Friday and says, you're supposed to be at the West Wing of the White House on 10:30 on Monday. And I thought, this is that Nazi again, the guy who called about my box being in the ditch. So I call the number thinking I'm going to get somebody at the zoo or something. It turned out it was the White House. They wanted me there at 10:30 the following day. So I wasn't coming from a big firm. I was district attorney. I had four kids. I actually flew standby. I had an easy way to get a free ticket. My sister-in-law worked for the airline. I had enough time that if it failed, I could rent a car and get to the White House. But anyhow, I got there, and it wasn't really until I was the night before I was supposed to be at the White House that it dawned on me that, my goodness, I could get this job. And I couldn't sleep the rest of the night, so I had a very restless night. I went to the interview the next day, and it was really with the White House counsel. It was Alberto Gonzalez, and I had probably a half hour, 45 minute meeting with him and a legislative aide, and that was about it. And it seems the questions they asked me were more intended to ensure that they would not be embarrassed, that there was nothing in my background that would come back to haunt them, more than the judicial philosophy or other things. And it was a relatively short interview. I know the other two finalists were interviewed.
Who were the other two finalists?
Joe Troy. And Tom Schober, who's a local attorney.
I had a drink with Joe Troy in the airport when he was going to for the interview at the White House.
Yeah.
I was in that German case I was telling you about. We were sitting on a Sunday in the bar having drinks, and I said, oh, my partner, Brian McGrath, his best friend in law school is Alberto Gonzalez. Really? Tell me all about it. Here, I'll buy your drink. Here, tell me all about it.
Yeah. Anyhow, after the interviews, I think it was right around Thanksgiving, I got a call saying, well, they're going to appoint you, but you can't tell anyone till because I think they had decided they were going to do ABA assessments or FBI background checks later, and it took a while. So it was kind of a secret for a while. But then in January, I was the nomination was announced, and then the confirmation came through in April.
And what was the confirmation process like?
We had a hearing before the Judiciary Committee. There were about five or six uncontroversial nominees. And when I say uncontroversial, I mean we were district court nominees. And there was one court of appeals nominee that was agreed upon by everyone. And so the questioning was pro forma. There wasn't any really serious questioning. And it went through very quickly. And the votes were essentially 97 to nothing. They were overwhelming votes. And it was interesting because Paul Cassell was one of the nominees that was in my early, they call it baby judges school when you're getting orientation later on. And he was on a different panel. But Paul Cassell had been I think he was number one at Stanford. He was a law clerk to Berger. He had been a Utah professor, law professor, and was in Justice Department, was one of the leading lights behind the sentencing guidelines. Very, very impressive credentials. But he barely got through. He had signed on to a brief recommending they overrule Miranda. And that was like the kiss of death. My sense is that if you had the district court nominees were not given the attention that Court of Appeals nominees and obviously Supreme Court nominees were given at that time, unless you had a record of positions that would have, for example, on abortion, and you had Supreme Court kind of on your forehead there, material, Supreme Court material, then I think you would run into problems getting confirmed. But for the most part, the district courts were not as contested as it became, and as you see now. It's a much different world, it seems.
I'm going to shift gears now and talk about law clerks and law clerk hiring process and what you look for. Judge Abrahamian, what's the law clerk process like at the circuit court? What do you look for in hiring?
A warm body.
Whoever they'll give you.
Whatever I get. So in the criminal division, there's five judges in the criminal division. There was when I was there. We get one clerk for the five, and the presiding judge hires that one clerk. It's usually a law student. And there's not a ton of written decisions that are done in the criminal division. I did a few, as I know some others have done some. So that's why there's just one for the whole division. Family is the same thing. There are three judges in the family division. I was presiding judge. I hired a clerk, and there was probably enough work for that clerk. And if there's not enough work, they go watch a trial. Civil division, we get a clerk, and it's usually an intern. And not a lot of applicants. It's kind of hit or miss with the ones I get. I look at their grades. I try and look for like moot court, something that's more litigation oriented, because I want them to work on a draft decision. I want them to prepare a memo, I want them to get something out of the experience. So warm bodies. There's an opening coming up. My clerk is now moving on. So if anybody knows anybody.
Justice Bradley, what do you look for in law clerks? What's the application process like?
Well, I'm going to segue into, I am looking for a law clerk now. Application process is open. If you know anyone, please refer them to our website, leecourts.gov. With that pitch done, what I look for, we only officially get one law clerk and one judicial assistant, but most of my colleagues and I have opted to have two attorneys on staff. It's still very short-staffed. I can't do my usual lament after I hear what the circuit courts get, but of course we have a lot more writing probably that needs to be done. So what I'm looking for, if I had four or five or even three, I would love to have a diversity of opinion, judicial philosophy, but because I do not have that luxury, I am primarily looking for somebody who has an understanding of originalism and textualism, and most importantly, understands what resources to access in order to draft memos and opinions that are grounded in that judicial philosophy, which I hold. So that's of primary importance. During the interview process, and I have a few former clerks here so they could tell you more if you're interested, but I also ask whether their strengths lie in research writing or legal analysis. And usually most clerks I interview will say that their strength is in legal research and they're looking to develop their skills in writing and analysis. And that's perfectly fine because I think the research skill set is the most important for law clerks. I utilize law clerks differently depending on whether I have somebody who spent 25 years in the appellate court system or if I have somebody right out of law school. But most of the people that I hire are really interested in developing their writing skills. And so I try to give my clerks an opportunity to write as much as they would like in drafting opinions. And depending on the term, they certainly get a lot of writing experience, and we divvy up those responsibilities between my two clerks, depending on, we try to anyway, depending on where their interests lie.
Justice Bradley, do you look for people with experience after law school? Is that a qualification you look for, or is it primarily people right out of law school you're hiring?
Well, right now, I am looking for somebody who has some other prior experience as a practicing lawyer, because I, again, have two open positions. I usually fill those positions with lawyers. Typically, I have somebody right out of law school, and then I have somebody who will stay on with me for a few years, and it's valuable if that person has prior experience either in the court system, in the judiciary, or as a practicing lawyer, and to hold on to that institutional knowledge of that person is really valuable to have at the Supreme Court. I'm looking at Judge Grogan. I still miss her very much, I'll just say.
I miss you too.
but it's helpful for the court to have in each chamber somebody who has been there for some time, because there are a lot of nuances that are specific to the Supreme Court, so it's helpful to have that institutional knowledge. So,
Judge Griesbach, what do you look for in law clerks?
District courts get three chambers positions. It's traditionally a judicial assistant or secretary, and then two law clerks. Most of the judges have eliminated the judicial assistant and go with three law clerks. Judge Adelman has somehow managed to get four. I'm not sure how he did that. But I have two. I've kept my judicial assistant, my secretary, especially when I was chief, I needed that administrative skill. And the other thing you see in the district courts is the presence of career law clerks, people that want to do this nothing's permanent, but as a career almost, and some have gone all the way to retirement. And when I first started, I had no intention of doing that. It seemed I had been a law clerk. I always viewed it as the way to start a legal career, but you don't want to remain somebody else's law clerk, you want to build your own career. And but I quickly saw the wisdom in having at least one of your law clerks with some experience. The district courts are, there's so much coming in. There's so many cases, there's so many threshold issues under the, you know, the habeas, the prison litigation reform, class actions, all, and then just the jurisdictional questions that if you're constantly going with a brand new lawyer, it is, you'd be in trouble. So first of all, I try to talk anybody who wants to be a career law clerk, I try to talk them out of it, because I tell them this is not the way you build your career. But both times I've hired someone as a career law clerk now, and I have one now who's been with me about 5 years. But it was her idea. This fit well, and she liked doing it, and she was very good. You can tell pretty quickly who has an aptitude for this. As I said, I encourage her to think about this, because this, you know, this is, I would say, not normally the way to get to be a judgeship, but my former career clerk judge is now a magistrate judge in Milwaukee, Judge Steve Andrees. And there are different districts around the country in which career law clerks have moved on from that to clerk of court or to magistrate judge and even Article III judge. The chief judge of the Southern District of Indiana, I think Judge Rosenstengel, was a career law clerk. So you can see how that happens, but I think that trial experience is something that you won't get in that position. You'll see a lot of trials perhaps, but you won't actually do them. But in looking, the other one's a term clerk, and that's usually a 1 or 2 year term. And in hiring that person, or either clerk really, you need at our level a lot of organizational skills. Research and writing are both very important, analytical skills, because the number of decisions we issue in any case, and you know, just I think the River case lasted 10 years, the Fox River cleanup. And I think we had over 400 decisions just in that case. Now, luckily, that was a pretty unique case, but we get multi-jurisdiction cases, the patent cases, some of the intellectual property stuff can leave you with a lot of issues, a lot of motion practice. And that's the nature of federal practice right now. It's very writing intense and a lot of motion practice. So those skills are what you really want. I look for someone really with common sense. It sounds like, okay, what's common sense? But it's somebody who has some appreciation of life and the importance of things and can keep things in balance. You know, sometimes I think almost the higher you go in education, the more you lose common sense. Judge Kaczmarek was talking about expressive individualism in Carl Truman's book, which is a very interesting book. But some of the craziest ideas are coming out of universities. perhaps
what?
You've noticed.
No.
And law schools. I hope I'm looking for someone who can see through some of that and has not lost their senses about what's real and what's not, that there is such a thing as right and wrong. There is a real and an unreal. There is true and false. So if nihilists need not apply.
I'm going to add that to my job description.
That's right, yeah. Put that on Oscar. I'm going to throw out one more question, then we'll open up to audience Q&A. So besides the lamentable view, what is the biggest adjustment from leaving private practice to becoming a judge? I'll start with Judge Abrahamian. Do you want to start
sure.
with that one?
So if I stay till 5:30 at the courthouse, the janitors are there, and they're like, oh, burning the midnight oil here. It's like I was at Foley and it's 10 o'clock. It's totally different. People ask me, are you stressed now that you're a judge? You're making these big decisions and affecting people's lives. And I say, I sleep like a baby. I was more stressed when I was a litigator, and I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm like, oh my God, I have that deadline. Did the associate get their expert? Do we have a summary judgment? What's going on? Did the client pay their bill? And then I just stay up, or I'd have a notepad. I have to jot things down before I go to sleep. I sleep like a baby. Not very stressful, and that's there are some cases I will say that I think about the like day before, like a big I was talking to Mr. Cuss, a big OWI homicide, and that trial, that sentence is a whole afternoon, because we have the Hatfields and McCoys, we have the victim's family, we have the defendant's family, and everybody wants to speak, and it's very stressful. No matter what you say, somebody's going to be very irked. So those are the ones where I kind of stay up a little bit the night before and really think about it. But other than that, I have confidence in the attorneys that are practicing before me, and my ability, and the clerk's ability, and a lot less stress, I would say.
Justice Bradley?
I would not say a lot less stress. I was describing to you earlier the kind of night and day time frames of my legal practice that occurred occasionally. It's kind of like that being on the Supreme Court, because particularly during the pandemic time or election times, the workload can increase. We get more emergency types of cases presented to us. And so it's very much a kind of on the job all the time, no matter where I am. I mean, like in private practice, you go on vacation, but do you really? No, of course not, right? You have your laptop and your phone, and if your clients need you, you're there. And so I can't remember the last time I actually went on a vacation that didn't also involve work. And that's not a complaint or a lament. I love what I do. But to answer the biggest adjustment question, that's got to be being in the public eye. In the private sector, you have ultimate privacy. No one really pays attention to you. Nobody knows who you are. Thankfully, I'm not very recognizable in public, which is a good thing. But it's I don't think anybody ever really gets used to, and it's been, again, 10 years for me, being caricatured by the press, having almost everything that you do in public life being completely misrepresented, usually by the media, but also by lawyers who didn't like the outcome that they got in court. And so that's a big adjustment, the attention. When I went to law school, I went because we all have this, not all of us, but a lot of us have this sense of, we want to make a big difference in the world. And I actually had a goal for myself of running for public office. And then I realized how much I hate politics. I said I would never run for public office. Well, here I am. 10 years ago, I decided to make that jump. But it does come with a cost. You sacrifice not only for yourself, but for your family, a private life. And you open yourself up to attacks that are unfair and personal, and death threats and all of that. So that's the biggest adjustment, and it's something that I think all of us in public life just have to continue to deal with, and it's part of the job.
Judge Griesbach?
The big change, and going from private practice to state court judge, my experience I think was a lot like Judge Abrahams. Sorry.
Good enough. Don't call me late for dinner.
In practice, you have the thrill of victory, the agony of defeat. And as a judge, your goal is to preside over a fair trial. The outcome, that's the jury's call. Or if it's a motion, you do your best, and the Court of Appeals will tell you if you're wrong or not. In that sense, I think in practice, attorneys feel responsible for the outcome of the case, even though a lot of it it's so dependent on the facts, it might be dependent on the jury or the judge, things beyond your control. And yet, it's your reputation you feel, it's your professional improvement or whatever that's riding on things beyond your control. And I don't have that sense. But then in state court, a lot of it, the volume is there in terms of there's a lot of criminal stuff. Much of it's processed. Much of it's, we used to call it pleas and piddle, just to go through a day of misdemeanor and traffic. But then the felonies would come, and those are important. But then the civil litigation was, the motion practice was much less in state court than it is in federal court. Then when I switched to the federal bench, you know, I wasn't there till midnight, but a lot later, and beyond when the janitors went home. There is just a lot more work. You could be there, I feel, sometimes 24/7. I'm not there 24/7, but there is enough that's constantly coming in. It's, you know, when I remember growing up, they used to say, "Don't make a federal case out of it." Well, we now make a federal case out of everything, and you know, we see it. Even if it's not all that meritorious, it takes time, and you're going through that stuff. And the other thing that comes with one of these positions is you feel it's an honor to have it, and you want to be deserving of it. So you end up putting pressure on yourself to try to do to try to put in that effort and to try to get things out. Not as successful as you would like to be, but I think there's that pressure that comes with that sense of the position you hold is so important, and you're fortunate to have it, and you want to do your best.
Well, thank you all. Let's open it up now to audience questions. There is a microphone, I think, somewhere. Yep, Zana has a microphone. So anyone has a question, if you want to come up to the microphone where it's at the stand there and fire away.
I guess I would direct my question to Justice Bradley, but it could easily be addressed to any of the judges. And I know, Justice Bradley, that you and Justice Hagedorn and Justice Karofsky look a lot different in person than you do in a Phil Hands cartoon. So I think you're right on that point. But what would you like your legacy to be? Would it be simply self-fulfillment and knowing that you stuck to your principles and did your job that way? Would it include a landmark decision that you hope would persuade other jurisdictions and change the law for the better? What are your thoughts on that?
That's a big question and a great one. I hope that my legacy will be, and that I would be known for, always defending people's constitutional rights, our liberties, defending the first principles on which our country was founded. That's what I hope my legacy will be. That's what drives me, what drove me to the judiciary, to make sure that there is a judiciary that understands that we're supposed to interpret the Constitution according to its fixed meaning and not insert our personal beliefs or our politics into our decision making, and that the most important oath we take is to defend and uphold and support our constitutions. So I hope that's my legacy. I hope that's what I'm known for.
Judges Abrahamian and Griesbach, do you want to take a turn at it?
No. That if you walk down the hall to walk Chuck Courthouse and said, what kind of judge was Judge Abrahamian? He was a lawyer's judge. He was always prepared. He was diligent. He was on time, and he ran a tight ship. And he was fair. I mean, that's a pretty good legacy.
Yeah, I don't disagree with either of those. I don't know if legacies are for later other people, but I guess I would want to have the reputation of being a fair judge, hardworking. The things that are within my control certainly are my temperament, the way I treat people. I hope I try to treat people respectfully. Try to be an efficient and effective and fair judge.
Other questions? You've left a room full of lawyers speechless.
Oh, boy.
There
we go.
Uh-oh. Here comes trouble.
This is for Justice Bradley. Who's your favorite colleague and why?
She's not under oath right now.
My tennis partner, of course, even though we lost.
That was unfair. This is a question I have for all of you. You all talked about your backgrounds and your careers before you were on the bench. And I was in the DA's office too, and I worked at the Wisconsin Department of Justice. And in both of those work environments, I worked with a lot of people. And you all did too, working in the DA's office and working in larger firms. Just rather than thinking about your career in particular, that you went from a firm to the Milwaukee Circuit Court where there were 47 judges, and then you went to the Court of Appeals where you were one of, was it four or five? and now on the Supreme Court where you're one of seven. In my experience, it feels more and more isolating. When I was at DOJ, there were 100 lawyers. When I was in the Dane County DA's office, there were 30 other lawyers for me to bounce things off of. And I went to Dane County and I was one of 17. Now I'm one of seven. And the people you can rely on and talk to and the people who are on you just get smaller and smaller and smaller and more isolating, at least for me. I guess I'm curious if you three have had the same experience. And if you have, what do you do about that challenge? How do you handle it? Because you're all three clearly people persons.
Especially as a trial judge, and I'm the only federal judge in Green Bay, so you're right about the isolation, but I think you have to have something more than the courthouse, I have a large family, I have other friends, I'm an active member of a parish. Those other activities and those other functions, I look to those to broaden my horizon maybe and get away from the court sometimes. But even a seven member court, those are seven people you can talk about the case with, although maybe what you hear isn't, it's not as easy to talk at the court with other colleagues. But that's intended to be a collegial court. Trial judges really aren't supposed to get others, take a vote of their colleagues about how I should come out. We try to do it ourselves. You bounce general ideas maybe off of people if you're in a court, but it is pretty isolating as a trial judge, I think.
In Waukesha, I'd say we're very collegial. Judge Maxwell is here. His office is just around the corner. We talk, I don't want to say every day, but almost every day about different things we're doing. I talk to Ramirez almost every day. Judge Lazar, when she was there, we talk all the time. We have a very good relationship, and we're personal friends, and we bounce ideas off each other on how you handle certain types of cases, things like that, and ways we can change procedure to make things a little more smooth. So that sense, it's very collegial. And then I do a lot outside. I have a poker group. I've been playing poker for 20 years, every second Thursday of the month. Great group of guys. Play Sheepshead, right, Pascupic? We'll get one of those going for 20 years too.
I didn't find the circuit court isolating. I thought I would, moving from private practice with lots of attorneys around. But I mean, private practice, a lot of the work is isolated, right? You're writing a brief or you're working on a contract. You're still interacting with people periodically. But I loved being at Children's Court. I had seven other colleagues, and they all knew that I had no experience in children's court, obviously based on the background I shared with you, that. So I had a lot to learn, and they were just wonderful, wonderful to work with. Everybody was really helpful and helped train me to learn this new area of the law. And then of course, obviously, Justice Kurowski, you're on the trial court bench, you're constantly interacting with people. You better be an extrovert, because you'll be exhausted by the end of the day if you're an introvert. So I didn't feel isolated. I was interacting with people all the time. I was at the Court of Appeals for 5 months. That's isolating. That's a very quiet, solitary, monk-like existence. Supreme Court, it can be isolating, but we all work differently. A lot of us work from home most of the time because most of our work is reading and writing, which we necessarily need to do on our own, right? It's a solitary life there. But when we're at court, when we're in session for oral arguments, rules, hearings, in conference, we're interacting with each other, with our staff, with our law clerks, with our JAs, with other people. We get to interact with the attorneys, at least during oral argument. We have meetings, we have so many committees and groups that we oversee as the Supreme Court. So there's a lot of opportunity to interact with the public, to interact with lawyers. We all have speaking engagements. So I don't find the position to be nearly as isolating as I think a lot of people would imagine. And then of course, we have a little bit of time for our personal lives, which is of course very important to not be in the role of justice 24/7, but to have people who know us at the personal level and interact with us, not as judges, but as regular human beings.
I'll share one amusing anecdote on the isolation in the Court of Appeals. I had a law school classmate who was working at the district attorney's office and applied for a clerkship with a judge who shall remain nameless at the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, and did the interview, but then got the rejection letter saying, you know, you've been in the DA's office, you seem like you enjoy action and being in court, you're really just not going to enjoy working at the Court of Appeals. I'm sorry, it's not going to work out. I think we have time for one more audience question, if anyone else has one. If not, sure.
This came to mind when there was a discussion of fewer cases going to trial. And I have a colleague who has been a trial lawyer his whole career. And I remember him having a conversation with another lawyer about, well, who do you trust more to make the right decision, the jury or the judge? So what do you think?
Well, the bench trials are much more work for you, aren't they?
Bench trials are more work. I tell you what, I tend to find juries get it right. I don't know your experience.
In criminal cases. The jury is essential for criminal cases. I really, that's where it makes the most sense. Civil cases too, I think they're good. But on some civil cases, I can understand why you would say, I'll go to the judge, particularly with, some contract matters, or like Justice Bradley was saying, go to arbitration or some other mechanism.
And I have in my courtroom, I have To Kill a Mockingbird, Atticus Finch, and I have Jimmy Stewart in Anatomy of a Murder. And sometimes I tell the jurors as they're doing their peremptories, I'm like, I don't know what kind of signal I'm sending to you. In both these cases, the jury's got it wrong.
12 Angry Men.
12 Angry Men's a good one, too.
All right, well, please join me in thanking this wonderful panel.
Good job.